This talk is produced in the spirit of AA's 12 step to carry the message. Members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's 11th tradition regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films and use of this talk. Anonymity to this extent is actually a practice of genuine humility. We assure that humility, expressed by anonymity, is the greatest safeguard that AA could ever have.
I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA.
Is Clancy.
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to see everyone here, all the people up in the half measures balcony. It's nice to be present at this affair. I was telling Peggy about this a couple weeks ago. I should tell you that I've enjoyed my trip here. I've had a pleasant trip. I've always liked to come here, and my friend Marlene, who I had the mixed blessing of sponsoring for the last 36 years. But she has done very well, and she's always a good hostess. She has a room for me and a bathroom that I can just run around and run amok in and see a lot of old friends. I saw my friend Bill, who came all the way from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and his charming wife, Kay, and a lot of old friends and a lot of new friends here. And it's been a pleasant trip. I had a bad trip a few months ago. I was asked to come and speak in Reykjavik, Iceland, which is about 500 miles beyond any lengths. It really is a... and the only one of the bad things about it, you have to take Iceland Air. That's the only way to get into Iceland Air. And it's like kind of riding on the Mexican State Railroad, you know, just... But coming back, I was tired. It was a Sunday night, and I had to get back to home to work. And I had about a five-hour layover in Minneapolis. That's what you really need, is a five-hour layover in Minneapolis on Sunday night. But I sit in the red carpet room, and I finally... had to go to the bathroom, and I went into their little bathroom. They have two little side-by-side things, and got a guy's leaving already. You ought to hear the end of this, pal. It's going to be good. Just remember where he left his overcoat. And I was sitting there minding my own business, and all of a sudden, a voice from the next stall said, "Hi there." I couldn't have heard it. This is ridiculous. And pretty soon the voice says, "What are you doing tonight?" I thought, I better get this settled right away. I said, "Well, I'm going flying back to Los Angeles to see my wife and my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandson who lives with me. That's what I'm going to do tonight, and thank you for asking." I thought that ought to chill it a little bit, you know. I didn't want to tell him I was too old. There was a long pause, and the voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight if you wanted to." And I said, "Will you stop it? I just came in here to do my bit. Why don't you just do what you're here to do and let it go with that? Let alone." And there was a long pause, and the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. This asshole in the next stall won't shut up." Well... but I am very happy to be present at this anniversary. This is a good group. I've watched them form it. I watched it gradually overcome resistance from pockets of resistance around it. Most activist meetings reach pockets of resistance because the people say, if you're active and we're not, that means either we're doing something wrong or you're wrong, so it's better that you're wrong. And that happens all over the country. Groups like this have started up. In Minneapolis, there was a Central Pacific group started in it. They took up petitions against it. Now it's the largest, most successful meeting in Minnesota. And it's that way in a lot of places. And they adhere to the traditions, which may seem like just old hat. But I remember coming here many years ago and talking to a very big speaker meeting. Was it on Lexington? Was it in here? Right in here, yeah. No, And it was the biggest meeting in New York, big speaker meeting. And little by little, they realized the traditions weren't really necessary. They got away from alcoholic talking to alcoholic. They got away from this and that. And pretty soon, it diminished and diminished. One day, it was just gone. They're all gone. And that's happened to a lot of organizations in this treatment. Some of you know that interesting story about in 1840, six guys got together in a bar in Baltimore. One of them had just got out of jail. And he says, you know, that down in jail, they all said they understood how I feel, but they don't. You guys are the only ones who do it. And we're all drinking so bad. Maybe we can help each other stay sober. Okay, we'll do that. So they drew up a constitution, and they all signed it. They elected officers amongst the six of them. And everybody laughed. These six boobs can't keep themselves sober. They're going to now work on each other. But somehow they stayed sober. And little by little, they got a few more people in. And some guy came down from Philadelphia and heard this and went back and got a couple guys in Philadelphia. And somebody went back to Washington and got something started. And they decided to call themselves, nobody ever heard of drunkards trying to help drunkards before in history. First of a kind, so they named themselves after George Washington, because he had done something nobody else had ever done before. At the end of a year, they had several states. At the end of the second year, they got started in March, like this meeting, but they chose Washington's birthday as their anniversary, because it seemed to go the name Washingtonians. And just before their second birthday, they wrote letters to all the groups they knew that could hear of. And they were really growing pretty well, and they said, now this year, on February 22nd, have somebody from your community come in and give a talk. Not that we have anything to tell us, but they will see we're not crazy, because they had a reputation of being crazy drunkards. So all over the country on February 22nd, 1842, people gave little talks. And interesting, if you read the book of Lincoln's speeches, he was the one selected in Springfield, Illinois, to come and speak. He spoke to the Washingtonians. He gave a long talk. I got a copy of it. But the synthesis of it all was that the people like you who I know are intelligent and sensitive, good people. And the only difference between you and me that I can see, I don't have the thirst you have. I don't understand your thirst, but you're doing something about it. But anyway, and then they got a couple of really spellbinding speakers to be members. And they'd go around and give big public talks, and hundreds of people would show up. And now get this, at the end of 5 years, it was estimated their attendance was 100,000 sober drunkards. Can you imagine? There had never been any group had any, and they got 100,000 of them. Which may not sound impressive to you until you stop and think AA with telephones and radios and television and all sorts of, and magazines at the end of 5 years didn't have 1,000. And these were all just one to one. And then they did something in 1845 that seems reasonable, because a lot of people in AA today think it's reasonable. And they got thinking, if we could help drunkards, we should be able to help all kinds of people. We should be able to help narcotics addicts who are not drunkards. In those days, not heroin and cocaine, but opium and laudanum. We ought to get involved in politics and use our good sources for politics. Maybe a lot of them got in the temperance movement. If we stopped the sale of alcohol, there'd be no more alcoholism. Some of them got involved in getting Texas into the maze. I mean, just all of these 100,000 guys put their shoulder to the wheel and they to help society. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct. And with very few exceptions, they all died drunken deaths on the street. I had a book home written in 1861 by one of its survivors. He said, I don't know what happened. We were doing so well. Then people seemed to lose interest. They didn't want to do the things we were doing. They were helping so many other people. And they all went down. And I'll tell you how extinct they became in 1944. Just 100 years later, 45, AA was going down the toilet. They had this big surge after the Saturday Evening Post article, and then it started to die off, and Bill Wilson sat in his office in New York, and every day there's a new letter from a new group that was going under, and people fighting and arguing and terrible things. He didn't know what to do, and some guy in North Carolina sent in a story. He said, you ought to see about the Washingtonians. And he didn't know what the Washingtonians were, so he looked them up and discovered there'd been a group that had really been very similar to AA. And he saw what happened to them. And so in a desperate attempt to save Alcoholics Anonymous, drawing on the Washingtonian experience and the experience he saw in Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat down in 1945 and wrote the 12 traditions. And that's where they came from. They didn't come out of the forehead of Zeus in 1939, they were based on thousands of alcoholics getting drunk. And in a sense, that's why you may want to sometime give a little more attention to the traditions, you know. We sometimes just think they're in groups to see if newcomers can pronounce autonomous, but they really are rather important. And he wrote them in the long form. I know most of you, we almost heard it tonight, but... Well, Frank, come on. Get with the program, Frank. His uncle is here from Pittsburgh, and he's scared. Anyway. But anyway, in the long form, if you're not familiar with them, in the back of the book, across in the short form, which was read, there's a long form, which is the same thing but fleshes them out. But that's the way they were written, and they were introduced in the new magazine called The Grapevine. Just started one by one. And I'll tell you something. AA then had the same basic problem it has now. It was full of alcoholics. And people said, we don't want your leaves! We want love! You know? And most people rejected it. They didn't want to hear it. That's when Bill Wilson used to ride around on his motorcycle with his wife in the sidecar and visit places trying to explain, I'm trying to save AA. And I'll tell you how bad it got, really. This is not really funny at all. People would ask Bill Wilson to come and speak at their meeting on one condition. You do not mention the traditions. If you do, withdraw the invitation. I mean, that's kind of tough. And so things were still going to hell. And at the end of the 1940s, Bill and Dr. Bob, they always got along together. The people in Akron hated the people in New York, and the people in New York hated the people in Akron. But they got along well. So they said, we ought to have one big meeting somewhere. So the people who are upset in Los Angeles and Houston and Chicago, because it was really polarized. People in Chicago would not write to the people in New York, to the office here. They'd only write to the people in Akron. People in Los Angeles have nothing to do with Akron, just New York. And just people getting drunk and crazy. And so they told their followers to set up a place. Let's have a meeting, one big meeting. So the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting, but we're not going to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together, and they came up with a Solomon-like decision. Cleveland. So in July of 1950, the first large group of sober alcoholics in the history of the world met in Cleveland. I have the tapes of that convention. Very fascinating. They had six young guys. Each of them got two traditions to explain and try to explain. These are not rules. These are not laws. We have no enforcement procedures. We still don't have any enforcement procedures. You can break every tradition again and again. We can't keep you out of a meeting. The World Service Office may send you a letter, but you can ignore it if you want to. You may die as a result of it, but I mean, you don't have to do it. And, you know, we have no AA police, which is a mixed blessing, because some of us old-timers feel there's a place for AA police. You know, for example, in my hometown, even though it's untrue, I have a reputation of being a dictator-type sponsor. And it's hard to explain to people. It is impossible to be a dictator-type sponsor without having the 100% cooperation of the dictatee. Because all he has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. And that's why I think we should have AA police. Maybe you could come in the night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp. We're going to go through the steps. The big thing, but Bill Wilson put it to a vote there. And if you hear that, even, I mean, I hate to say this because it doesn't sound like he was a perfect man, and he obviously wasn't. He was a great man. But you hear the tape. He wasn't sure if he could still sell the concept. So he goes, now you've heard the traditions. Seeing no objection, we now accept them. So So the next printing of the book, the tradition's written, and they've been there ever since, and they really are very vital. One of the interesting things of that convention, though, just in passing, is the co-founder, Dr. Bob, was dying of cancer. And they said, well, you probably don't want to talk, Bob, because you're so sick. Oh, no, he said, I'm 15 years sober. Next to Bill, I'm the only one west out here that's got any sobriety. And so on that day, his son and another guy took this tall, gaunt, sick figure to the microphone. And some of you have heard that talk. It's on tape. But he said something, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to proceed along the same lines. And he says, I'm glad that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. So I want to apologize for my health. Hasn't been very good. I've been in bed most of the past few months. But then he really got and gave a succinct definition of AA that stands up today. He was so desperate. He was trying to give not a deathbed confession, but a dying admonition based on everything he knew, because he was a very, very great AA member. He said, there's two or three things I wish to call to your attention. And these things are just as vital tonight in this meeting or anywhere else in the world. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists somewhere, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us be sure to guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room who doesn't know exactly what he was talking about. Because we're all very nice when things are going our way. Yeah, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. But let somebody hurt your feelings, or you're threatened, or you're tired. bitch! Yeah. And finally he said, none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken the time to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it, to help us through. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we're too busy to help our fellow alcoholic. Then he sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But we accept the traditions, and the traditions have been part of it. And I hope that whatever groups you go to, that you will defend those traditions, because sometimes they're under some great attack. There's the great attack, of course, for years in the third tradition, which killed the Midtown group. You know, it says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. That doesn't have to be an alcoholic. Don't have to drink. Just have a desire to stop drinking. And people come into AA and say, I never drank, but I have a desire to stop drinking. I'm going to vote. And how do you keep people out like that? Because you can't. But then you have to go to the long form of the traditions. It says when they condensed it, they had no idea this would happen. The long form is written, said, we are here to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. And when they condensed it, they just tried to make it abbreviated. They had no idea that someday, years later, non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. You know, you can't get alcoholics in, you can't keep the non-alcoholics out. You know, it's just... But there's a school of thought, you hear it from time to time around AA. Oh, it's all one big disease. Alcoholism, drug addiction, gambling, overeating, it's all one big disease. Do you know where that came from? That came from a treatment center that only has one van. That's where that came from. Because the thing that makes AA so unusual and why it works when nothing else does, and the thing that made the Washingtonians work, they are the only two times in the history of mankind in the treatment of alcohol problems where drunkards are talking to drunkards, not doctors talking to drunkards, not religious people talking to drunkards. And it's a really remarkable thing, because most of us realize and know that the greatest enemy we have faced probably in our recovery is that little voice inside of us saying, but your case is different. You are a little different. You're not like these people. Your problem isn't quite like them. And that feeling of difference is what killed alcoholics. Now, AA is everywhere in the country now. You know, every city's got AA. 134 countries, I guess, have got Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just everywhere. It's not necessary for alcoholics to ever die from drinking again or have any problem with it. And you just go to meetings, it's free, nothing to it. But there's something wrong. In America now, where there's more huge sobriety than any place in the history of the world, and there's AA everywhere, it is estimated that something over 90% of alcoholics still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. And people say, why would this be? Doesn't AA work? Yes, it does work. But what doesn't work, or what is the problem, is that voice inside of us saying, I'm not like that. My case is different. I'm in a situation that probably none of you are in, I presume. These days, when I go to work in the morning, I drive my car downtown, through Beverly Hills, downtown, middle of downtown, get out of my car, and I have to step over the bodies of men and women, sometimes children, dying from alcoholism and drug addiction to get to my office. And when I go home at night, I step over the bodies of dying men and women. Some of you have been in my office and done the same thing. And you think, why don't you do something about those people? And when I first went there some years ago, I really thought I could. But it finally struck me. If good intentions could make people sober, if my wishes could get them to straighten out, why did I slip year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after good people were helping me trying to stay sober in AA. And then I started off as kind of a high bottom drunk. Then I became kind of a medium bottom drunk. And finally I became a low bottom drunk. And the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission and said, and stay out of here, you troublemaking bastard. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a troublemaker. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote were running that very weekend in Life and Time and Serving Post, The New Yorker. I've had my picture in The New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people here have had their picture in The New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. I stood outside that damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning. And if a guy came up to me and said, you know, you're dying, pal, why don't you go to AA? I'd tell him, you don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. And if he might have said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic, I would not have been able to do that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and delineate the differences. So I probably would have had to do it people like me when I get in that situation. I get afraid and I'm cornered. And the defense you use then is bluster. Say, oh, get out of my face, you son of a bitch. Lay down, get away from me. Because I'm afraid and I don't want you to find out. I know now why I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. Because I'd been going to AA off and on for years. A lot of places I went to AA first because I thought maybe it could help me with my sensitivity and why I drank too much. And I discovered that they weren't interested in sensitivity. They don't understand why I drank too much. I remember my first meeting. I went into in the Midwest a room with about seven or eight old guys sitting around a table, gray hair. Just I thought I was in God's waiting room, just a bunch of old. What really hurts me now, they all were about 20 years younger than I am now. But it seemed to me, all the time about their drinking and how they got sober. My net result, I remember from all those days, I went to those meetings, maybe a week, was some old guy saying, I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. And just then I moved to a different city, and my problem is, I don't know how to explain to people, my problem isn't drinking. I finally read chapter 5, or heard somebody read it, and I heard my problem. Grave emotional and mental problems. Because I could stop drinking anytime. My problem has always been this. From the time I ran away from home when I was 15, early in the Second World War, and I drank my first glass of, I held down my first drink of whiskey that I ever held down in Pearl Harbor. I saw that movie Pearl Harbor a few months ago. The plot was terrible, but they certainly recreated what it looked like. I was looking for me being vomiting somewhere in there. And And what I discovered as I grew up, that the few drinks of alcohol changes me. Because, you know, I talk about my emotions, my feelings of inadequacy, my feelings of fear, sometimes my feeling of not fitting in, sometimes feeling of superiority, feelings of inadequacy, all kinds of feelings. You can talk for an hour. But I think I would put it this way. If you're supposed to go through life like this, it seems as far back as I remember, I'm like this inside. I don't know what it is. I don't know what's... There's something missing in me. I don't know what it is. But when people get close to me, apparently they can see that because they don't seem to like me as well when they get close to me. And I don't seem to fit in with groups as well as other people seem to fit in. And I can't make conversation like some people can do. And people don't seem to have confidence in me somehow. And I don't feel good a lot of the time. I feel secret emotions. I hate even those kind of secret emotions. And I've discovered when I was a boy and thereafter that there's one thing that kills that, nothing else. I wouldn't have thought of that same analogy then, but when I have a few drinks, that scale goes away and I feel fine. And then I drink too much sometimes and then I get back and the scale is a little bit worse. But I don't drink because I don't explain this to people. I've stopped drinking for how many times? What happens to me is this. I wouldn't have, again, thought this, but as an analogy. I can stop drinking for a while, but eventually somebody sneaks into my bedroom and puts an invisible spring in my gut in the middle of the night. And the next morning they start to tighten it. And one day the restlessness comes back. And the irritability with all this crap going on. And it's taking this junk from people who I'm supporting, who are living off me, and God damn it, they give me a lot of problems all the time. What I do, I deserve a little relaxation. And on, it gets kind of bad sometimes. And I know one thing. There's only one way that changes that feeling, and that's two or three drinks. And eventually I drink. And I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I don't know how to explain to people. I drink because I'm a feeler. But then sometimes I drink a little too much. Or as I prefer to feel, I have been many times thoughtlessly overserved. Then I have a tendency to act bizarrely. I went to a psychiatrist for too long one time, and he pointed out to me that I had been repressed as a child by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. How'd you like to find out your own church had repressed you and didn't tell you? And he said, when I drank, I just was breaking free of those old bonds. I said, God, that seems right to me, but I explained that to an arresting officer one night. He didn't go for that. But I did a lot of things. I know that I drink too much, and I know I got to do something about it, and I read books. I became somewhat... Eventually, I grew up, and I got married, and I married a Catholic girl, which Lutherans should never do, because they're just too tough for us. And she was a good girl, which is even the worst kind, because nobody ever tells Lutheran boys, but if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are just about to have a big family, whether you plan on one or not. And I started my next career became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just, boom. I said to her, can't we use birth control? No. But if you really think about it now, things were a lot different there. You young people have no idea this, but in those days, nobody talked about such things. Nobody talked about it. I mean, once in a while, you'd see some kind of a bad kid, and he'd say something like, I got a rubber. And he'd have to get someone depraved to go in and buy him. And even they would be ashamed and say, hey, give me some cigarettes.
And some rubbers.
And now it's 50-some years later, and things have changed a great deal. The drugstore by my house, kids come in, they're 50, and they must be older now, but they come in and say things like, hey, I want a package of condoms.
And some cigarettes.
Yeah, so. So I had to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations. I got some good jobs. Every so often I drank too much, from time to time, I'd go to AA. After a while, I just did it to take the heat off. And yet, if nothing else, If your employer thought you were trying to help yourself and gave you 2 more weeks to look for a job anyway, and you go home, and I'd say to my wife, "Well, Charlotte, I've gone back to AA." She'd say, "Good, wonderful. It'll work this time. What do they want you to do?" "Well, they told me to taper off." And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's peace for any slipper anywhere. "We have the same stuff you do. We know what you do. I release you, you son of a bitch." Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. But I had a terrible time. As I said, I went to psychoanalysis. Loved psychoanalysis. I never could understand. Later I discovered why I thought about that is that I didn't really understand, because in psychoanalysis, you know, all you ever hear is bad news. You hear how you've been hurt in ways you hadn't understood yet. "You mean there was a depression that hurt me, doctor?" I never could, but I liked it. I used to want to drink. "No wonder I feel so bad. God, my life has just been..." And I never really understood that. I never really understood that till some years later. When I was sober a few years, one of the guys sponsored was deep into adult children of alcoholics. And he said, "I want you to come with me to a couple of these meetings." And I said, "Sure." And I sat with him. And all of a sudden, as I heard them talking, I realized what psychoanalysis had done for me. I'll tell you what it had done. Of all the emotions I know in the world, the worst one is guilt. That's a deep-seated guilt thing you should have done, especially if you've had religious training as a child. It really grinds you. It gets to be a suicide thing. Sometimes I think that this side of the scale is just a big hunk of guilt. Guilt of the things you've done, guilt of the things you should have done and didn't, which is even worse sometimes. Now, what did you think of a therapy that could get rid of guilt? Pretty good, huh? That's what it did for me. And I think that's what AAC did for its parishioners. I'll tell you how they do it. They convince the patient that he or she is and has always been a victim. It is not your fault. They have failed you again and again. You have not been nurtured well. They may have meant well, but you were damaged. I really didn't understand the intensity of it, but I could see it. And they think, well, to get rid of guilt, why not? Well, you'll discover there's nothing really free in the world. There's a little price tag for everything. There's a little price tag for getting rid of guilt, as you can imagine. 3 little price tags. But you don't see them as you're going through them. You see them later in retrospect as you look back. And one of these little price tags is, whether you intend to or not, you must sustain and enhance resentment. Because that's what it builds. Intense resentment. If you go to some of these meetings, there's no laughter in those meetings, pal. It is intense. And it's not even funny. It's just intense. Almost a competition and see who feels as bad. And you walk out of there and you don't walk into people talking and laughing. They walk out. And it's an intense thing. The second thing that you have to accept, although you don't know at the time, you must accept the fact that you are irrevocably different. You've been made different. I really didn't understand that. I heard one of the guys say one time, we are like trees. When we were saplings, someone reached within us and destroyed our inner self. And physically, we continue to grow, and we look indistinguishable from other trees. But we will never have any heart or soul because it's been destroyed by unfeeling hands. And the last one, of course, if you're like me, it's easy to understand. Intermittent but intense self-pity. Boy, look, I could have been something. I really could have been something. You know? Of all the lines in movie literature, I think the one that jumps off the screen at me, Marlon Brando sitting in the back seat with his brother and saying, "You know, Jimmy, you should have taken care of me. You're my brother. I could have been a contender." And boy, yeah, I understand that. But these are kind of inconveniences, these 3 things. You think maybe it's worthwhile to get rid of guilt. Because guilt is a lethal thing. And maybe it is for most people. But it turns out it isn't for people like me. And I didn't know that till years later when I was looking through this book and I ran across something strange. The 3 most lethal emotions for people like me is resentment, feelings of difference, and the feeling that I'm different. feelings of difference and the feeling that of self-pity. And why are they so lethal? Because they will justify every drink I take till I die from it. And it will never have been my fault. And you don't understand. And that's a lethal thing. I don't misunderstand me. I know that some people had very difficult childhood. Some parts of my childhood were bad. And some parts of your childhood may have been bad. You may have had unfeeling parents, or you might have a lot of difficulties. But turns out the point of AA is to eventually do these things until you stay here, until you can get to the point of finally acknowledging that was bad. But that was then, and this is now. Dr. Bob's son, they call him Young Smitty, about 78. He's not very young anymore. But he's a good friend of mine. I was joshing him a few years ago. I said, well, you're going to be the next president of ACA. You're the original adult child. And he said, no, I do not choose to spend the rest of my life playing out the role of a wounded 16-year-old neurotic. And I said, oh, not much of an answer. But that's why I have to be very careful. I've never known an alcoholic in my life, I don't think, who has not dabbled in victimization. Because it does make things look a little better. You don't have to take responsibility for your own actions. None of us want to do that. But the concept, one of the great, great freedoms in Alcoholics Anonymous is to stay here and take these actions and acknowledge them and do those amend steps and do these unburdening of self until you actually, one day you feel different. But I didn't know that then. I spent a lot of money. I had another difficulty. I could not return to God. Because what if you're new? Here's what AA is. You come to AA and admit your problem is alcohol. Then you return return to God, and then you show your gratitude by helping others. And that's not for me. My problem really isn't alcohol. I drink too much a lot of the time, but it isn't. You don't seem to understand. And I can't return to God because in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, when you've broken enough commandments, you better just keep moving. And when I came to AA, I remember having to tell someone, I've broken all 10 commandments. Some of them accidentally, but I've broken all 10 commandments, and I don't want to hear about God. It wasn't for about 2 years after that that I finally realized I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Next time I go to Minneapolis, who knows, you know. But I can't return to you. I joke about it all I want, and I give... You know, one of the great freedoms I found was I used to read a lot of stuff I couldn't understand. Read German philosophers. That's good. You know, you just, huh? But if people are looking, you say, how true. But one of them, a guy named Nietzsche, was always my favorite because he's such a cynical, rotten thing. And I just, yeah, that's right, Frederick. And I just loved it, except you get to the end and you discover he died in the insane asylum. So you have to backtrack and say how that happened. He wasn't really crazy. He just had a terminal case of syphilis. You know, just a good time guy like you and me. But one of his great works that I appreciated, one of his protagonists said to another, he said, why are you so concerned about God? God is dead. Perhaps he once existed to set the orbs awhirl, but look about you, chaos, anarchy, nothing except the mind of man. I remember reading, I said, God is dead. That's sure good news. And I really, that was great. In fact, there's a theological seminary in Chicago that has that on the wall. It says, God is dead, signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. Unfortunately, beneath it says, Nietzsche's dead, signed God, 1906. You just never want to read the second part of anything in a seminary, that's all. But I kept drinking, because it was my only escape, and I tried to stay sober. And if you're new, you might think if you really wanted to stay sober, you could. I also thought if I really wanted to, I could. And I had a reason once. I was in jail one night. I was in jail a lot overnight. I'm no felon. I'm no big criminal. But sometimes when I drink, I have an unstoppable need to counsel police officers. I just stop unjust arrests sometimes. You can't do that. Oh. And I was in jail last night, and they had to come down in the morning and tell me that my son had died the night before, and they couldn't find me. I was out drunk. And that made me feel so bad, I couldn't stand it. And when we buried him, I took a vow in his casket that I'd never drink again. And I had a great sense of freedom. I was working in Texas then, El Paso, the college there. And I had a great sense of freedom. My son was dead. It was almost like Easter. If he had died, I felt so bad. But he died for his sisters and his mother and I to have a life together in his memory. And it just was wonderful. Except one night, somebody snuck into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day it started. The irritability, and all of a sudden, I didn't much like this town anymore, I didn't like this job, and now combined with it, tremendous self-pity. What kind of a stinking God would kill my son to punish me because I'm bad? What kind of a stinking, rotten God? And hate it. And the days went along, and the job, I didn't like the job anymore, pushing my daughters, who I was doing it for, their noise was, "Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For God's sakes, let me alone. I'm sorry, we'll play tomorrow." I just hate myself. But if I could have two or three drinks, I could eat. But I've taken a vow in my son's casket not to drink. And so one day my wife took the kids to Mass, and I pulled my car in the garage, hooked up a hose, and turned on the exhaust and died. The guy next door found me in there, walked over there and found me dead, and pulled me out and examined me, and they put me in the Texas State Insane Asylum for quite a while, gave me a lot of shock treatments. Now that's how I guess when I stopped drinking. Now how can you call that an alcohol problem? It's a problem, something wrong inside of me. That scale is out of the way, boy. And that's why it's strange to find myself coming here again year after year to get up here and say the same things. A strange thing happened to me on my way to my death. One more time I got out of that cold rain by walking into an AA club, and it kept raining, so I had to do things they said so I wouldn't be sent out in the rain again. And I let these idiots tell me what to do, these boobs. And somehow or other, I took some actions that changed my life. And I'd been in and out of AA for years. And this was the first time I ever did the things. I did them only because I developed a confidence in a guy who I thought understood me. I guess that's the miracle of identification, they call it. And eventually, I lived in the backseat of an abandoned car in the same club parking lot for months, and I had no front teeth for a long time. It was just terrible. This guy was a fanatic. I said, "Bob, I'm living in the backseat of an abandoned car, Bob. People I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn last year ridiculed me in the meeting because I'm such an ugly-looking thing. I have these old clothes. What could I do?" He said, "Get a job." I said, "Get a job? Look how terrible I look, Bob." He said, "Get a terrible job." So I got some jobs. I'm awesome. I'm glad I was so hungry because I kept getting work, and I eventually stayed sober. And eventually, one day I was going to commit suicide, and I was 6 months sober, and he used that pain to get me to write an inventory. Then I told him, "I've written my inventory with the psychiatrist. Why don't I take him to out of work actor? What are you going to say? Cut, you know?" But little by little, over the period of time, I took the steps. I want to tell you just a couple of things before I sit down, before this timekeeper runs amok. I finally came to understand what was wrong with me over a period of time. I'm going to say it in a couple of minutes so I can get into it. My sponsor finally pointed out to me over a period of time in various ways. I told him my problem is alcohol. He said, "That's the only right thing you believe, kid, as I can parse you. I can tell your problem is alcohol." I said, "It isn't? What is it, Bob?" He says, "Something that sounds like alcohol, and they look so similar that people die from it all the time. But it's not alcohol." I said, "What is it, Bob?" He said, "It's something called alcoholism." I was disappointed. "Oh, Bob. That is semantic. Save that for the idiots, boobs coming in here doing anything. I'm a very brilliant man. Don't play semantic games with me." And he said, "Isn't a semantic game, kid? Just shut up and listen." He used to explain things to me like saying, "Why don't you shut up?" And that's the only time I really missed my front teeth. But I didn't want to give him the pleasure of gumming it. But he said, "A drinking problem, and most of us think we have it. I'll tell you how you overcome it. When it gets bad, you stop drinking. You clean up your act, and you're all right. However, this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me and millions of others looks exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, but why would anybody drink? He said, because the physical aspect of alcoholism is this. We all talk what it does to us. Oh, put me in jail. Blah, blah, blah. That's not it at all. That's just way down the road. The thing that makes an alcoholic different is this. Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. In two or three drinks, it must change your perception of reality. I said, yeah, doesn't it do that for everybody? No, it doesn't. That's why they're not here in the meeting, and you are. I went, Jesus, Bob, I understand that, but but you don't seem to understand. People talk about how the drinking causes them to feel so bad. That isn't me. Me feeling bad is what makes me drink. It's just the opposite. He said, why don't you just look at the first step? He says, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. You've lost control of drinking. Then there's a dash. Doesn't say anything at all that's due to your drinking. So now you have to admit your life is unmanageable. You think your life's unmanageable? Not really. Says you're living in an abandoned car in the parking lot. Is that any kind of... I said, I'm just kidding you. So not Malibu. The richest man in America spends three or four nights a week in AA meetings, and he can buy chains of treatment centers and buy all the psychiatrists and buy all the counselors. They can have them lined up for a mile outside of us, and he goes to their meetings and says, why do you think he does that? I don't know, Bob. He said, because he's found as an alcoholic. That's what changes his life. I said, why would that be, Bob? He said, look, we're all born with emotions and feelings. We grow up, we go through something called a maturing process where you go through conflicts and work your way through them. And you have situations and you dig and you learn and you find out how to cope with these situations. And some of us seem to be a stroke of luck. We find out that taking a few drinks, you can evade the conflicts. You don't have to work your way through the crisis situation. You can escape them. Get around them. That's great. Except if alcohol does this for you, eventually you have to come to depend on it sooner or later. And then you have to have a problem. Now you got to stop. I'm going to stop drinking now. And then you discover something that you don't know that you're discovering, but it's terribly painful. The things you evaded in your maturing process are here waiting for you to be dealt with. He says, and the sad thing is this, kid, you wind up with grown-up bodies, grown-up brains, grown-up ability, grown-up charm, grown-up everything, all at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds better. But they're childish emotions. I hate you. You hurt my feelings. I love you. Just look at the school ground. You see, I identify. He said, you can't deal with them. So eventually it gets so painful, you got to relieve the pain. So you drink. You wind up in a situation that nobody outside of rooms like this would ever understand. You can wind up drinking to forget you're drinking. Because drinking creates a problem, and you do that to get rid of the problem. And then you drink till you have to stop drinking. And you keep stop drinking till you have to start again. Back and forth. Till you die or go mad. But the one thing you always know, but you don't understand, my problem really wasn't alcohol. It was all these other things. And they never understand that alcoholism is the problem. And that the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to make you better or make you good or do any of these things. It has a series of steps that, much to the surprise of everybody in the world, let me tell you this. A long time ago, Dr. Jung told a guy named Roland Hazard in his hospital that the only way you're going to beat alcoholism is to have a spiritual experience. And in the first years of our existence, the only one that had a spiritual experience was Bill Wilson. And when he wrote the first copy of the book, he said, step 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message. And after it was out, the kingdom said, Bill, You're the only one who had a spiritual experience. We didn't have one. So, and you didn't have the result of these steps. You got these before you even thought about AA or watched anything. And you said, how can that be? And so they had a lot of, book didn't sell. They had a lot of time to think about it. And finally, they stumbled onto the beginnings of something that most of us come to understand here. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that people are sober, because you can get sober anywhere, but that you stay sober. And I think what Dr. Jung said is correct. There must be this spiritual experience, only it's a much different one than Bill Wilson had. Turns out these 12 steps bring about some form of incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his, boom, but the way we get ours. Make amends to that woman, I should say not. And what happens in a spiritual experience, it gives you an altered perception of reality. And the 12 steps of AA, to the best of my ability, are designed to give you an altered perception of the steps of the reality. AA is designed to really very slowly do what alcohol does fast. And that's why it's so important we must keep doing it. I was at having lunch today with a general manager of AA World Services. We were talking about an odd fact. In the first, incidentally, when they wrote this, printed the second version of the book, they changed the 12th step, having had a spiritual experience, and how it's become having had a spiritual awakening. That's what the fact is. But most of the stories in the first edition of the book, the writers, most of them died drunk. In the second printing, most of them died drunk. Now, why would that? They weren't bad people. Because they weren't yet aware that alcoholism is a continuing thing. They thought if you get better, you're okay now. And it took a long time to realize this is not a disease like pneumonia where you get sick and better, but it's like diabetes where you get sick and you take your insulin and you'll say you'll be all right. And the great thing about this is that it's done in a way that's so hard. We all come to AA with our scales out of whack. And these AA people say, I say, I've got this terrible big black thing in my scale. I can't do it. Well, we'll just forget about that for now. Are you crazy? We're going to work on this side. There's nothing wrong with this side. And you get a little bucket of actions. And one day the damn scale starts to move. What's that funny feeling? Must be feeling decent. And one day the scale is there, and most of us have been sober a while know that feeling. My God, I'm feeling all right. But through some coarse celestial prank, there's a tiny hole in this side. And every time you just get that baby going, oh, I'm so happy. I'm so grateful today. It's wonderful. I just, oh, Jesus Christ. Endless digging in that damn thing. Because we absolutely insist on feeling good. It's just dreadful. But that's what's so good about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what it's designed for. And I'm glad I didn't have to return to God. As he pointed out to me, you have to come to believe in something. And I came to believe in my sponsors, my higher power. People laughed, but he saved my life. I actually came to believe in AA, and after he died and I fell in the hands of some spiritual people, I came to understand that God loved me. He didn't hate me. That's my childish perception. He loves me no more than you, no less than you. Now you might say, how about these people? Tomorrow morning, I'm going to catch an early plane. Before noon, I'll be stepping over bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. Doesn't God love these people? You bet he loves them. Then why are they there where I used to be and I'm not? And you can take psychological profiles, you can take insights and all sorts of social, economic things, but the bottom line is this. They are unwilling to take actions they disagree with, and they're going to die from it. That's all. It's just that simple. Because AA tonight, in the Atlantic Group on its 9th anniversary, is exactly the same as it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. It's not this book. They didn't have any book. It's not all this song and dance. Not readings and all this stuff. Not an AA dance. We wallflowers all put dances down. What AA is tonight, as it was then, and will be as long as we do the work. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that day comes, your life changes. See you.